dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We have the privilege at the Center for Security Policy, which makes this show possible, of being led by a career intelligence professional. Our president and CEO is Fred Flights. He served not only in the Central Intelligence Agency and Defense Intelligence Agency for some 20 years, he was also a professional staff member of the House Intelligence Committee and served in two capacities as the chief of staff to John Bolton, first when he was Undersecretary of State, and most recently as the National Security Advisor to President Trump. Fred is the author, among other things, of Obama Bomb, a very important analysis, I think quite influential at that, about the Iranian nuclear weapons program. And that's what we want to talk with him about today. Fred Flights, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Hey, Frank. Good to be here.
So there have been some important developments since we last talked, Fred, on the Iranian nuclear portfolio, which you've studied so closely for so long. Let's start with this report that the Iranians have now seen fit to prevent the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, from conducting such inspections as they were able to previously. What does it mean, if anything? What was the effect of those inspections heretofore?
Well, Frank, there's two interesting stories that are interrelated here. One is that the Iranians are refusing to cooperate with an IAEA investigation of a nuclear facility, a storage facility in Tehran that Israel discovered and publicized last year. And at the same time, the French are offering $15 billion to the Iranians to prop up the nuclear deal with Iran.
$15 billion?
A $15 billion letter of credit to Iran. This came out in the Wall Street Journal today, Monday.
Issued by the government of France?
Issued by the government of France. This is hot off the press, and it is basically to compensate Iran for the losses it is incurring due to U.S. sanctions on its oil sales. But let's get to that in a minute. Let's talk about this refusal by the Iranians to cooperate. Israel discovered this facility that had not just nuclear equipment, but fissile material in Tehran last spring and told the IAEA about it. The IAEA didn't bother to inspect it until April of 2019, by which time it was empty, but they still found evidence of nuclear material. The Iranians are refusing to explain or cooperate with that investigation. And the IAEA recently put out a report that sort of played down Iran's clear violation of the nuclear deal and refusal to cooperate with an IAEA investigation. Now, this is important because it is just one of many examples of Iran failing to cooperate with the nuclear deal, just as the French are trying to bribe the Iranians to stay in this fraudulent deal. So this is all big news.
It is. But let me just go back. How important, Fred, were these IAEA inspections when the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was being observed? Am I right that they were not able to look in a number of places in Iran where there was abundant reason to believe Iranian nuclear weapons related activities were taking place? Were they looking, as they used to say, about the drunk who was trying to find his keys under the lamplight, even though he dropped them someplace else because the light was better there? You know, it doesn't necessarily translate into real insights into the nature of their program, does it?
There are several ways Iran has not been cooperating with the nuclear deal. One is that it has refused to allow inspections of military facilities where just about all experts believe that there's covert nuclear weapons activities going on. That's where it's happening. They're also having false and misleading answers on excess production of fissile material, which the IAEA has tried to write off, or allowed Iran to correct before it issued its reports. Iran also has produced too much heavy water, which is used in a process that can produce plutonium, the most desired nuclear weapons fuel. Iran got around that by storing its excess heavy water in Oman, and the IAEA let it get away with it. So, I could go on and on. Iran wasn't cooperating with the agreement in the past, but this particular violation is one that's so serious, even the IAEA can't pretend it didn't happen.
Yeah. But there's an awful lot of pretending going on, and apparently that would include on the part of the government of Emmanuel Macron in France. We saw him last week going through these antics of bringing the Iranian foreign minister to the margins of the G7 meeting that was taking place in France. What would happen, Fred, if the government of France actually provided $15 billion to this Iranian regime under present circumstances, as you see it?
Well, let me also add, I think the Germans are in on this, too. I don't think it's just the French. The French are offering this letter of credit, but I think the Germans are going to help pay for it, too. This will pay for half of the losses the Iranians reportedly are incurring. I don't think it's going to improve Iranian behavior. The Iranian economy will still be a disaster because it's still it's such a corrupt and backward mess. But we know what this money will be used for. It will be used to pay for terrorism. It will be used to pay for Iran's nuclear missile programs. Iran lives for this. It lives for blackmailing the West. The West eventually cries uncle, tries to pay off the Iranians, and the Iranians go through this cycle once again.
Right. I was going to say, Fred, that it's not just that it's not going to improve their behavior. It will actually underwrite their bad behavior. And we'll be talking with former Undersecretary of Defense Douglas Feith in our next segment about some of that behavior as it is manifesting itself at the moment in Syria, and of course, through its proxies in Lebanon. There is reason to believe this thing is very, very much ratcheting up, perhaps to the point where there will be a very horrific regional conflict out of it. And it just seems the height of irresponsibility, not to say a sabotaging of President Trump's maximum pressure campaign for the French, presumably with their German partners, engaged in this kind of sweetheart deal for the Iranians under circumstances in which it just seems even more irresponsible than most of the French and German behavior is most of the time.
That's right. The liberal elites in France and Germany are putting their hatred of President Trump ahead of their security concerns. I mean, Iran's failure to cooperate with this nuclear deal. They know this. They've always known this. They've always known that this deal is a fraud and it will not accomplish what it's supposed to accomplish. But they signed this agreement with President Obama. They refuse to back away from it. And they're not going to do something because it's what President Trump wants them to do. It's outrageous. And it is going to undermine international security. We know Hezbollah, Iran's terrorist proxy out of Lebanon, has been starved for funds because of President Trump's maximum pressure campaign. President Macron is going to give those funds back to Hezbollah.
Yeah, it is outrageous. Fred, thank you so much for your leadership at the Center for Security Policy, as well as joining us each week. Next up, we will speak with Douglas J. Feith, former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, about Iran, but also about Afghanistan. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I couldn't be more pleased to say we are joined by Douglas J. Feith, a longtime friend and colleague, a very formidable contributor to our national security over many years, notably in his role as the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy from 2001 to 2005. These days, Doug is the senior fellow and director of the Center for National Security Strategies at the Hudson Institute. He is the author of one of the most important books on the subject of the war we find ourselves in at the moment. I call it The War for the Free World, current phase. He calls the book War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. Doug Feith, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us.
Nice to talk to you.
Well, you were there inside the Pentagon at the dawn of the war on terrorism, which, of course, involved, among other things, an attack mounted from Afghanistan with the acquiescence, if not active support, of the Taliban against the United States, mounted by Osama bin Laden and his friends in Al-Qaeda. We are, as we speak, apparently in the process of negotiating some sort of agreement with the Taliban. An old friend and colleague of both of ours, Zalmay Khalilzad, is the negotiator for the United States, that would involve the withdrawal of some number of American forces. The president seems to be saying now he'll keep some still there. But what is your take on what's likely to come of this if such an agreement is indeed completed?
I'm skeptical about the Taliban fulfilling any promises that it makes in these negotiations. We have an important interest in Afghanistan in preventing it from reverting to a safe haven for terrorists who target us. And I certainly understand the general impatience that people have about, you know, when will this all be over and when will we have the ability to walk away and stop having to defend ourselves. But that kind of impatience, as understandable as it is, I don't think is a good basis for strategy, because sometimes you just have to maintain defenses indefinitely in order to keep your country safe.
As has been said, the enemy gets a vote after all.
That's correct. And the idea that we lose patience after a while is a big strategic vulnerability. And we're in a peculiar situation where our enemy is not a country. The circumstances are not such that we can score a victory once and for all. You know, ever since the war on terrorism started, we've had this problem that our enemy is a kind of vague collection of terrorist networks, a network of networks. And you can't score the kind of decisive once and for all victory against them, which means you have to continue to deal with the threat that this network poses.
I want to refine this a bit, because it seems to me that what we're dealing with is not just a network of networks of terrorists, but we're dealing with an ideology that animates them, and for that matter, others that use techniques other than terrorism to advance the same sort of supremacist agenda. I think of it, Andy McCarthy calls it Sharia supremacism, and I think that's an apt phrase, but it is unfortunately persistent, widespread, aggressive, and almost certainly going to be greatly enabled or at least encouraged by the perception that one of their cohort, the Taliban, has achieved a strategic victory over their principal enemy, namely us. No,
I think that's a serious danger. I do think it's important to recognize that what makes the network a network principally are ideological connections. And I mean, the network of these jihadist groups, and each one of which is organized in network form, in as opposed to kind of, you know, corporate hierarchical form. I mean, that's part of the thing that makes this a great strategic challenge, is that it's a lot of loose connections in many cases among loosely connected groups. And the ideology is the thing that ties all these elements together. I'm not sure that you and I would quite agree on how we define the ideology. I believe it's important to distinguish between the jihadist ideology and Islam itself. I don't think they're the same thing.
Within Islam, there is unquestionably this thing called Sharia that its adherents, I think, are now very aggressively trying to impose on all of us through these varying techniques. And this brings me to another point that I would argue characterizes Sharia. You wrote about it in the National Review recently, a manifestation of it, I should say, anti-Semitism. And you pointed out that this is rife in Arab societies. It is focused primarily at the moment, I guess, in the case of Israel, but it's pretty virulently being applied more generally to Jews in Europe, notably, to some extent, even on the floors of the United States House of Representatives. Give us just sort of a quick appreciation of this phenomenon and why it seems to be burgeoning at the moment.
The jihadist groups generally promote a conspiratorial view of the world. And two of the major groups that are focused on are Western imperialists in general. And the idea is that in their propaganda, you see, is that the United States is now the leader of the Western imperialist camp, as they see it. And the other main group that they focus on are Jews. And so in their conspiracy view of the world, the Jews and the imperialists together are their font of evil.
It would seem to me, though, that if you drill down a little bit further, there is, you know, rabid anti-Semitism in some of their sacred texts as well. And this is the conspiracy, maybe again, the sort of manifestations of or the motivations for their immediate action. But it's a wellspring for this kind of, you know, jihadism of either the violent kind or the more stealthy kind, and very troubling, needless to say, especially to the extent it seems to be being sort of acquiesced in or even endorsed by some in this country now. And Doug, it brings me to another question for you quickly. And again, our guest is Douglas Feith, former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. You have, over the years, been deeply immersed in the challenge posed by what I would call one of those Sharia supremacist regimes, that of Iran. It seems at the moment that Iran and its various proxies, notably Hezbollah, are now increasingly at the point of coming to blows with Israel. Well, there are blows being exchanged, of course, but perhaps on a vastly more extensive scale. Give us your sense of what's happening now, both in Syria, Lebanon, and more broadly in this regard.
The Iranians have been trying to change the strategic picture, especially regarding Israel, but even more broadly throughout the Middle East. They've become very aggressive. I would say that a major reason for this is the decision that the United States took some years ago when President Obama was in office to stay out of the Syrian civil war so completely that it created a power vacuum that Russia and Iran together largely filled. And the combination of Russian and Iranian support helped accomplish pretty much the impossible, which was the victory of Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, in the Syrian civil war. The general view was that he couldn't survive that civil war, and he probably wouldn't have been able to survive that civil war had it not been for this major intervention by both Russian and Iranian forces. This was an enormous strategic victory for Iran, and for Russia and for Assad. And I think it contributed to an emboldening of Iran throughout the Middle East. And the way that emboldening has manifested itself is in Syria, the Iranians have been working on creating military installations and capabilities so that they could directly threaten Israel from Syria. The Iranians worked for many years to be able to threaten Israel by proxy through Hezbollah from Lebanon. Now that the Iranians were so active on the ground in Syria, they want to be able to expand the front from which they can threaten Israel, and they want to be able to do it directly with Iranian forces, not simply through their proxy Hezbollah. The Israelis have been working very hard to bomb the Iranians in Syria to keep them from developing that capability.
And Doug, I'm afraid this is a topic that we're going to have to return to on another occasion, because obviously there's so much more to talk about, and not least of which is, how does that play out both in Lebanon and in Syria, as the immense quantity of arms that the Iranians have imported, particularly into the former, are perhaps unleashed against the Jewish state. Trying times. Your expertise and insights, Doug Feith, are tremendously appreciated, as has been your service to our country. I know we'll have a chance to talk with you again in the near future. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Thank you for joining us today. Next up, Jessica Vaughn joins us from the Center for Immigration Studies. We'll talk with her about the crazy, dangerous nature of sanctuary cities. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a delight to say we're joined by Jessica Vaughn. She is one of the wickedly smart people who populate the Center for Immigration Studies, an organization in Washington I think is simply indispensable when it comes to matters involving both border security issues, but also interior enforcement of our laws. Jessica is the Director of Policy Studies at the Center, as well as a former Foreign Service officer and an instructor for senior law enforcement, and a great asset, I believe, to our country. It's always a delight to catch up with her. Jessica, welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be with you, Frank.
Well, the couple of things that I wanted to see what we could make sense of at the moment, one of them is here in the nation's capital region, Montgomery County is one of the jurisdictions in which the county executive, a fellow by the name of Mark Ulrich, has recently promulgated, in the not too distant past, I guess, has promulgated an executive order that essentially hamstrings cooperation between the county's law enforcement personnel and the Immigration and Customs Enforcement organization known as ICE. Tell us, based, among other things, on a wonderful piece that your colleague at the Center for Immigration Studies, Judge Andrew Arthur, recently wrote, what that means in practice. What does a sanctuary city actually do? And in the case of Montgomery County, what are some of the consequences of it?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, what sanctuary policies do is restrict local law enforcement officers from communicating with and honoring ICE requests for communication or requests specifically to hold non-citizens who've been arrested for state or local offenses from holding those individuals for ICE so that ICE can grab them and remove them back to their home country. And in practice, what this means is that illegal aliens and sometimes legal immigrants or people protected by DACA or other temporary forms of protection, after they commit crimes, they are released back into the community instead of being turned over to ICE to process them to go back to their home country. And what that means is, you know, just like American offenders, non-citizen offenders tend to go back and commit crimes again. There's a more than 50% recidivism rate among these criminals. And how this has played out in Montgomery County in particular is at least seven now illegal aliens arrested for horrific, violent sex crimes have been released back to the community and offended again. And these crimes shock the conscience, really. They are brutal sex crimes and were totally preventable if Montgomery County had simply honored ICE's requests to take these individuals off the street and send them back to their home country. But to the political leaders of Montgomery County, it's more important to obstruct immigration enforcement than to remove that small fraction of the immigrant population that's causing problems for other immigrants mostly. That's the really kind of
ironic
thing about this, is that it, you know, in the name of protecting immigrants, they're actually sending offenders back in to prey on immigrants. And it's there's no logical reason for this. These policies are adopted for political reasons. Law enforcement officers don't want to be obstructed from communicating and cooperating with a fellow law enforcement agency. And it's a huge benefit to the public safety to have criminals removed instead of sent back to the streets. I mean, of course, there are a lot of American criminals we'd like to deport, but we can't. In this case, we can send illegal alien offenders back home.
Right. And as you say, these local law enforcement officials bear the brunt of what happens when these recidivists engage in further criminal activity. I mean, in addition to the victims, most obviously, but it's the problem for local law enforcement, as they're responsible for, as you say, maintaining public safety. And it's being needlessly, and it would seem to me as a real dereliction of duty on the part of people like this county executive and others in sanctuary cities and the state of California, for that matter, that they're hampering law enforcement in this fashion, as you say, just for political considerations. It's hard to believe that over time, Jessica Vaughn, the politics of this is going to be very good for the people who engage in this. I've got to believe that the communities affected, both immigrant communities and non-immigrant communities, are going to be pretty irate at the consequences. You look at homelessness in some other communities, you look at violent crimes like this, it can't be a sustainable political strategy, it would seem to me.
It's not. It can be hidden for a while when the news media make a choice not to report all the facts about these offenders and mention that they're in the country illegally and mention that this person could have been taken off the streets by ICE. But we're starting to see that change a little bit. There's one intrepid reporter in Montgomery County for the local NBC affiliate who is reporting each and every one of these instances now. You know, once people become aware of what's happening, they do become irate about it. And, you know, the problem is that there are too many victims, you know, until the public becomes aware. And, you know, what they should be doing is preventing this from happening. Now they're reacting afterwards. But and the Trump administration needs to take more steps to target these jurisdictions for some consequences, whether it's by withholding funding or penalizing them in other ways. There was a lawsuit that was filed last week by Judicial Watch against a sanctuary jurisdiction in California. We're waiting for the Supreme Court also to take up a case that I'm hopeful will make it clear that law enforcement officers have the authority to cooperate with ICE, that it's not unconstitutional to hold people for ICE. It's not it's not an unreasonable arrest. And so this will clarify some of these situations, but you know, the politics are never going to change.
Yeah. But Jessica, this is really important that the Trump administration has, as I understand it, tried to take steps to penalize these jurisdictions, but of course they have been hamstrung by lower courts. So you're saying that we may be finally seeing, come the new term of the Supreme Court, action on a case that would hopefully address this this miscarriage of justice, really.
Yes. Now we have a circuit split on sanctuary policies, and we also have an appeals court in California that overturned a lower judge's ruling on the ability of the federal government to withhold law enforcement federal funding for jurisdictions for not complying. So, you know, they said, yeah, the Trump administration has the authority to say no to Los Angeles to get certain kinds of funding for police agencies because of the sanctuary policy. So it's starting to shift. I mean, I think we are going to see some movement on this very slowly, and I'm very hopeful for the courts. But in the meantime, people are getting killed and raped.
Yeah, it's just outrageous. Again, Jessica Vaughn is our guest. Let me quickly turn to one other issue. We don't have a lot of time on it, but just the quickest of quick forms on this. You've recently written a piece about foreign students and national security, concerning specifically the phenomenon of student visa overstays. And I noted in the report that some 13,000 Chinese students have currently overstayed their visas. This is a small subset of the larger problem that I believe is represented by, not necessarily all, but many, perhaps, of those, I think it's 300,000 Chinese students in this country. What can you tell us about this from both an immigration enforcement standpoint, Jessica, but also perhaps from, a counterintelligence perspective as well?
Yes. Well, we are very generous in the issuance of long-term visas to people who are accepted into American university programs, and also a huge array of lesser-known programs that also give access to the United States for people who are coming for to cause harm or to simply overstay and join the illegal population. There are about 1 million people with student or exchange visas right now, which is a huge population of people. The country that sends the most is China.
And by the way, it's not for our liberal arts programs, right?
No, not always. Sometimes for nuclear engineering, but also sometimes for dog grooming and yoga instruction or English language learning programs. It's hard to generalize because there are all kinds of things going on within the student visa program. What we do know is that these visas give someone a chance to stay here for a long time with little supervision. And that's why these are visas that are highly valued by terrorists and by spies. And we know that some governments, particularly the Chinese government, also the Iranian government, specifically take advantage of these programs and either send operatives or put pressure on their citizens to assist with espionage or other kinds of activity to benefit the foreign government. So there are all kinds of things going on. And then there's just a lot of fraud in the student visa program, and we don't know who's taking advantage of that or why. So we also know that these programs have the highest overstay rate of any other visa category, and yet there's very little enforcement on the part of ICE to investigate and remove these individuals before they can get started on whatever it is they're trying to do here.
Jessica, we have to come back to this. Thank you so much for the time you've given us today. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, Hans von Spakovsky joins us right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are privileged to have with us, as we do from time to time, a man I call HVS, Hans von Spakovsky. He is these days a senior legal fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, where he runs its election law reform initiative. He is also, among other things, a former member of the Federal Elections Commission, which is now unable to muster a quorum. He has served as a member of the President's Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. He is an adjunct professor at the George Mason University School of Law. I didn't know this actually, Hans, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for a series he did for PJ Media titled Every Single One. He is also the author of Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk, co-authored with John Fun. So much more I could say, but let's get on with the show. Thanks so much for joining us, Hans. Good to have you with us again.
Sure, Frank. It's great to talk to you again.
Well, I caught just now your short 3-minute sort of Prager University style video at the Heritage Foundation's website, in which you described election fraud as very real. And I know you know whereof you speak, having had the experiences and doing the research and study and, you know, practical things that you do, Hans. And yet, it is the narrative that is virtually universally propounded, not just by the left, but also by the media, that really isn't any such thing as voter fraud or election fraud. Give us the reasons why that's not so, and the sort of gist of your video, which very compellingly lays out how it manifests itself.
Yeah, you know, the media just, without even checking, investigating, or thinking about it, just reflects the talking points of liberals and others who are opposed to any kind of measures that would increase the integrity of the election process. And voter fraud is real. We actually started a database, Frank, a couple of years ago at the Heritage Foundation of proven cases of fraud from around the country, because I was tired of reading editorial pages saying, oh, there's no voter fraud in the United States. We just added a dozen and a half cases to it. We're at 1,216 proven cases from all across the country, and we have two dozen more that we're reviewing that are in the pipeline.
Now, that sounds like a fairly small number when we think about the number of elections that take place and the millions of people who regularly vote, Hans, but is there statistical reason to believe that that is the proverbial tip of the iceberg and suggestive of a very large problem indeed?
Yes, it is. The reason we know it's the tip of the iceberg is because there are so many other cases that never get prosecuted, and it's difficult to discover. Usually, it's just by accident that it's discovered that fraud has occurred, and oftentimes prosecutors don't go after them. And I'll give you just one quick example of this. Look, when I was on a county election board in Virginia a number of years ago, we found almost 300 individuals who were not U.S. citizens who had illegally registered to vote. About half of them had actually voted illegally in prior elections. We took them off the voter rolls, sent that information both to local prosecutors and to the Obama Justice Department, and absolutely nothing was done about it. So there's 300 cases that will never show up in our database. And the thing is, yeah, we have lots of elections in this country, but the place it could make a difference is in close elections. And we have close elections all the time. Listen, in January, a mayor in Gordon, Alabama, was removed from office after it was found that he had committed voter fraud to make sure he got elected in an election that he won by 16 votes. And that is, unfortunately, the kind of thing that we find when we go through our database and look at these cases from around the country.
But you're going through the database. It seems as though the people responsible for maintaining the official databases are not doing that very rigorously, especially when there are cases of people being registered to vote in more than one jurisdiction or even state at a time. The Pew Foundation, as I understand it, actually came up with a staggeringly large number of such cases. Tell us about that, Hans von Spakovsky.
Yeah, some years ago, they did a study and they estimated that 1.8 million people who are dead are still on the rolls, and almost 3 million individuals are registered in more than one state. Now, you know, some of those people who are registered in more than one state, you know, that's just administrative error. But on the other hand, we have cases in our database of people who took advantage of that to vote illegally in more than one state. And probably one of the most prime examples of that is just a couple of years ago, 2012, a Democratic congressional candidate in Maryland named Wendy Rosen was forced to withdraw. She actually won the Democratic primary. She was running against an incumbent Republican. She was forced to withdraw when it was discovered that not only was she registered to vote in both Maryland, where she was running for office, and Florida, but had voted in both states in multiple elections.
At the same time, Hans, in this terrific video that in, you know, very brief way, really communicates the nature of this problem, the manifestations of it through the ways that we've just described and more, you've offered some specific suggestions about what should be done. And I wanted to get to one of them, which is the most obvious, and yet it is the most ferociously contested by the left. And, you know, I think they've in some cases been successful in precluding it from being brought to bear as a corrective to this problem, namely the use of the requirement of government-issued IDs when you are going to cast your ballot. Tell us the argument for not doing that and how important it is to the integrity of our voting system.
Well, it's very important to the integrity of the voting system. Even people like Jimmy Carter, former Democratic presidential candidate, president, has said that that's something that ought to be done. The arguments folks make on the other side is one, there's no voter fraud. Well, we know that's not true. Many, many examples of that. But second, they say, oh, this is voter suppression. This somehow will keep people from voting, particularly minority voters. Well, we also know that's not true. How do we know it? Well, because voter ID laws have now been in place in a number of states like Georgia and Indiana for more than a decade. And not only does the turnout data show that turnout doesn't go down when voter ID laws go into effect, in many of the states that put it in, it seemed turnout went up after the voter ID law went in place. Nobody's quite sure why. I happen to think it's because it increases public confidence.
Your vote matters.
Your vote matters, and that spurs people to go vote. But the point is, study after study has shown it does not keep people out of the polls. And of course, that's because every state that's put in a voter ID requirement has also put in a provision saying, look, if you don't have an ID already, which 99% of Americans do, we'll give you one for free.
And the reason 99% of Americans do, or whatever the exact number is because you need them for all manner of things in life, not just voting. And yet this meme that this is somehow unfair or this is somehow a plot to deprive minority voters in particular of the opportunity to vote has been, you know, upheld in federal courts, as I understand it, in some cases. Where does this stand in terms of, you mentioned several states in which voter IDs have been practiced. Is there an official position of the Supreme Court on whether this is permissible or not? And if not, should we be seeking one?
Yes. In 2008, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Indiana's voter ID against claims it was unconstitutional. What happened after that was opponents quit trying to claim it was unconstitutional and started trying to claim that it was discriminatory under the Voting Rights Act. They actually lost the majority of those cases. They have won in one or two states, but in most states, they've actually lost those cases when judges have examined their lack of evidence that it's actually discriminatory. The problem is there's only about a dozen and a half states across the country that actually require a photo ID. And there are some fairly large states like California and New York that don't require any kind of ID of any kind.
Hans von Spakovsky, so much more to talk about. I hope you'll come back to us with further updates as this election season gets further advanced. It's inexorably approaching, and it's vital work that you're doing. Come back to us soon, my friend. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.